Welcome to the Compassionate Leaders Circle podcast. For thousands of years, the sages have known that compassion is a powerful force for good. In the last two decades, compassion scholars caught up with these sages, proving that there is an ROI to building loving communities and businesses. This podcast features leaders who can teach us about the power of compassion. It's my great honor to have my friend Colin Ambrose here with me today. We're having an East End of Long Island party. I was a fan of Colin's before we were friends because I am a patron of his beautiful restaurant, Estia's. And one of the things I really appreciate, Colin, is your staff is so happy and you're so respectful to them. And I observed that along with your amazing pancakes before we became friends. So welcome to the Compassionate Leaders Circle podcast. It's so nice to have you.
I love anybody who likes Estia's little kitchen and the pancakes here.
Well, I've tried all the pancakes on the East End and yours are the beyond the best. So we're here today to talk about Colin's story, his restaurant, his staff, how he got through COVID. And he's also doing some amazing creative projects. But I thought I'd just start with the beginning, Colin, and maybe you could just tell us the short story of how you grew up, how you developed your love for food, and how you ended up on the East End.
Sure. I am the product of two happy families. My grandparents, one family from New Jersey, the other from Southern Wisconsin, both took food seriously. And my grandmothers were both excellent cooks. My mother was also an excellent cook. So I just, I grew up eating everything and tasting everything. And my grandmother in Wisconsin had a huge garden, and having the experience of watching her and being involved in cooking from the garden seemed a natural entree to becoming a restaurateur and a chef. Along the way, I started out as a bartender. I started a magazine right out of college. I have a degree in advertising design for the restaurant industry called Top Shelf. It went as on a contract basis to every restaurant in the country that had a license to sell beverage alcohol. And I ran that magazine for 6 years. And when I sold it, I had an experience in the consumer magazine side with a company called Hearst on a magazine called Connoisseur. And that ended very abruptly when I was 30 years old. I was given a severance check. They shut the magazine down. I did not do anything wrong. I just was there at the wrong time. And I brought that severance check to the East End of Long Island, showed it to a woman who owned a coffee shop in Amagansett called Estia. And in 1991, I was able to buy that restaurant from her with my down payment of $8,000. And today I sit in Estia's little kitchen, and I've done six restaurants since that time. Three of them have been Estia's, and I've enjoyed every minute of it. I am a dyed-in-the-wool restaurateur. I love the daily routine, and I love the fact that I was able to become the chef through experiences. I did stages all over the country. I worked for Charlie Palmer in New York. I worked for Fred Eric in L.A., Michael Mina in Los Angeles, and I made the rounds. While I owned the restaurant, every winter I'd work for somebody else, and I've created my own cuisine, shall we say. Its focus is primarily on Latin food now, Mexican specifically, because I have a big Mexican staff, and it was a nice way for them to become, you know, more in tune with what we do here than just taking direction from me. And we work together, and some of these people have been with me for over 20 years now.
It's amazing, and you really feel the family atmosphere when you're there. And I was going to ask you where Estia came from. Now I know.
Yeah, it's a Greek word for hospitality. And since I'm not Greek, I early on decided that what it really means is established in Amagansett.
Oh, nice. Nice. And lucky for me, you moved over to Sag Harbor because that's where I live. That's where you are now.
Wonderful. Yeah.
I am very covering compassionate leaders and compassionate leadership. I was really impressed and astounded with how you and your staff came together to survive and maybe even thrive during COVID. Could you tell us that story?
Sure. COVID became a reality in a matter of days to us. We had heard about it. We do our job here in a remote market. It was the end of the winter of 2019-20. And early March, we started hearing a lot about it. And we were given some instructions about how we handle utensils, how we would sanitize tables more aggressively. But there wasn't a lot of information that came from, you know, the bureaucracy, shall we say, the health department specifically, very little, none, actually. It all came over the media. And one day, on a Sunday afternoon, it became very evident that it was time for us to have a staff meeting on March 12th, I believe it was, and discuss our family's approach to dealing with the COVID situation. And my staff, they're not much for making suggestions. I'm the guy that does that. I drive the ship. And so they all looked at me and I said, what I really want to do, I said, everybody's healthy today, right? And they all said, yes. And I said, well, think on Monday, we're going to close the restaurant down and I want the kitchen staff to come in, spend 2 or 3 hours with me completely emptying out. So today, everyone on the staff is going to take all the prepared food home, so that you guys can settle into your homes and not leave for 5 days. Kitchen staff came in the next morning. We cleaned the walk-in boxes head to toe. We cleaned all the refrigeration, turned it all off, and let this building go to rest. And for the next 4 days, everyone stayed at home. Now, at this point in time, we really didn't know what the gestation period or whatever you'd call it is for COVID. We didn't have that information yet, but I wanted to give my staff those 4 days to figure out if they had a temperature, if they were feeling sick, or if there are any symptoms coming up. And that didn't happen. So on Friday, I brought in a small order, and my sous chef and I did all the prep. On Friday, from the afternoon into the evening, we got the restaurant ready. I had created a pared down menu. So I created a menu that was basically about 50% of our regular programming. And I worked with my IT on creating a new menu for our website. We created some opening pages for the website that told the guests that we were going to go takeout only. We were going to be open Saturday and Sunday only. And we wanted to serve the community. Ultimately, I wanted to make sure my staff had income. And I wanted to see where we were going to go with this. Now, one of the things that came in handy was that 4 years earlier, my operation for the last 20 years has been breakfast and lunch specific, with a dinner program Thursday through Sunday night. So 4 nights a week dinner, 6 days a week breakfast and lunch. And we've always had that Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday schedule open. That bothered me for a long time, because in the Hamptons, you want to maximize every minute. So 4 years earlier, I had created a concept called Estia's Hot Burrito that was a 6-menu item menu, all burritos, and of course, guac and chips and nachos. So that was a very simple menu. I had 2 people in the kitchen. We served margaritas and beer and wine only, and I could operate that with a very pared down staff, and I brought in college kids to do that. And it was a branding experience. I had created all of the logos, and we had stickers and we had flags, and the core concept had been established for 2 years. And it didn't really go well, because the college kids have a tendency to quit on you before the end of August. And each time we'd lose half the staff to ridiculous reasons, like grandmothers dying and things, which, you know, I mean, I'm not saying that's ridiculous, but if the third time someone's grandmother dies, you kind of are wondering, right? So anyway, I had all the branding in place. And so we took the Estia's Hot Burrito branding and moved it to the front of the property. We used that as our point of contact for restaurant customers. No one came in the building until the end of February. And it ran extremely well for us because we pivoted the right time. We were early to the game. We were easily accessible, and we were providing flavors that people didn't create at home.
It's been great. And I'm so impressed that you didn't lose any of your staff, and your staff actually ended up making more money they would have if you didn't pivot, right?
In the end of the day, gross sales were up, costs were down, payroll was very streamlined. You know, there was the kitchen staff may have taken a little bit of a hit because overtime kind of got eliminated, but the dining room staff did great. And my dining room staff always shares cash tips with the kitchen, which I'm very proud of. That's not a program that I put in place. That's a program that they created for themselves. So they encourage that kitchen staff to be a part of the success of the restaurant. And what was interesting was that we had a lot of regular customers that were exaggerating their tips in cash. We even had people that were coming through. Everything happened, Laurel. It was quite something. Big orders. We never could handle tables of more than eight inside the restaurant. That's why we call it Estia's Little Kitchen. Now we were getting to-go orders for 16 and 20 people. We were putting them in bags, and there was no wait. There was no lag time. There was no waiting for the table to end. There were no dishes to wash. And so we watched our cover count grow. We watched our sales grow. And we watched our fixed costs essentially go down. Now, we did have costs in packaging that we had never experienced before. But, you know, the septic basically got eliminated. so many things that we generally pay that aren't really connected to the plate directly went away.
Yeah. Well, it's such a lovely story. And I attribute that to quick thinking on the leader's part. And and also having a team, you know, it's not unlike a sports team. Your team was already a team, right? You didn't have to create a new team in all of this, and you didn't lose your team members, which is amazing. And I just wanted you to tell that story because it's such a silver lining COVID story, and we need those. So congratulations on that. But Colin is a very busy man in addition to, you know, having a family and having a restaurant. He has a couple of other projects. So tell us about the American Rivers Tour.
The American Rivers Tour started for me in 2016. I was at that time, I had two restaurants. I had one in Connecticut called Estia's Back Porch Cafe, and I had one here in Sag Harbor, Estia's Little Kitchen. And I was not only working 12 hours a day physically in each of the spaces, three at one, four at another, depending on what needed my attention at the time, I was also driving a lot back and forth on the LIE. And I had reached a point where I was, you know, kind of bursting at the seams, and I needed an outlet. And I found myself sitting with some friends one day, and I voiced that concern. And one of the gentlemen at the table looked at me and he said, you know, it wouldn't hurt you to kind of visualize a way out of this. What would you really like to do? And I said, well, I think that if I could create a reason to go fishing that justified my time as opposed to just going fishing, that would be great. And he said, and this fellow was in marketing, and he said, well, why don't we sit down and figure out how you can accomplish that? And we did that. We had coffee several times through the question and answer and the help of friends. I've never been one to ask for help as much as I should. Through the help of friends, I was able to kind of create this vision board, shall we say, that was an idea that I would create a media property that would allow me to use my advertising budget to get on the road and promote my restaurants through cooking on the side of rivers with chefs all over the country. And so that's what I began. I decided to call it the American Rivers Tour. I've always been a river, I've been connected to rivers all my life. My uncle, my father's brother, Stephen Ambrose, was one of the great historians of our generation. And he wrote a book called Undaunted Courage that really, really turned my head. And he and I spent a lot of time while he was alive on rivers together. And it inspired me to try to open the idea of getting out on rivers and fishing and cooking on the river. And so I decided that I was going to chase that dream, and I created the American Rivers Tour. And by the time COVID hit, I had produced 15 videos in areas like, I was in Ohio, I was in northern Wisconsin, I was in Utah, Idaho, Wyoming, California, and all of these trips, they were really special to me, and they were effective in terms of my advertising program because they brought attention to my business through local and national media. And that really turned the key for me, because it's not like my YouTube channel has a million followers, but when I tell the story to people in the media, they oftentimes want to hear more about it, and sometimes they want to write about it. So it's justified in that way. It's a deck online now for people that are interested in fishing the driftless area of southern Wisconsin, for instance. You can go on my site and see what it's like to fish the driftless, and you can also get a great idea of what it's like to eat at the Driftless Cafe, because I fished with the chef from the Driftless Cafe.
So tell us a little bit, let's bring people into that world. So tell us a little bit about the chef and what you cooked and what the fishing was like.
I think that as much as I love the Driftless Cafe, in that case, Eric Thomas was the chef that I went out with. He works for a very highly regarded James Beard Award winner named Luke Zime. And they foraged for mushrooms prior to my arrival. And we prepared a simple mushroom ragout mise en place in their kitchen. And then we went out, and in the creeks and coulees of southern Wisconsin, you have to literally creep up to them on your hands and knees to fish them because they're so spooky. And we did that all morning. Then we went and started a fire and we made the ragu together. In another instance, I fished the Eel River in Humboldt County, California, with a great chef that had opened the French Laundry. And he had been involved in opening Per Se in New York. And now he's the executive chef for a winery in Napa Valley, but he guides on his days off. And this fellow did a beautiful steelhead trout with me where we went out and foraged for watercress. He brought the steelhead. We did not catch any fish. And quite frankly, that's why it's fishing and not catching. And it's all on. Those videos are on the website, and they have recipes that are also on the website. So if people are encouraged to try them, they can find out how to put those dishes together.
Fantastic. So during your pivot and working the front window of your restaurant and all the things you did, you also took on an interesting way to spend your Tuesdays.
Yeah, I did.
Tell us about that. Tell me about how the idea came about this year.
Well, it was a stressful year for me in that I have not been a waiter for 25 years. And the staff was tight, and they needed someone who, I had to be a leader as much as a waiter with each customer, because people were confused. They had to wear the mask. They didn't know what we were offering. They knew what they wanted because they used to come here. Everything was kind of wonky. And so I became the lead waiter, and I worked a window where I would take an order from a customer in the window, and then I'd answer the phone and I'd go back and forth. And I did that for almost a year, Laurel. And I had hit a point where I needed an outlet, and I was greatly missing my trips for the American Rivers Tour, but I couldn't leave the state of New York. And so in January, I read about an initiative that Governor Cuomo had made during his campaign time to build a series of trails in the state of New York that would provide everybody in the state an opportunity to ride a bike or walk from Manhattan to Canada. And then there's also another spur that goes from Albany to Buffalo. But I what was beautiful about this trail, it provided me with two things. First of all, it provided me with the opportunity to have an adventure in the state of New York, so I didn't have to quarantine. But as far as the American Rivers Tour was concerned, this was the greatest river trip of all time, because I traveled the entirety of the Hudson River into the lake, into the Erie Canal system, and then on up Lake Champlain to go on a fishing trip that was 3 days. So I spent 15 days riding my bike to go fishing. It was a 15-day trip, 340 miles by bicycle. And in the end, on the last day, the only time it rained the whole time, I went fishing for northern pike and largemouth bass, and the fishing was fantastic. I caught a lot of fish, big fish, and I fished the Adirondacks for trout. That was fun, and I have a real memorable experience that I'm creating a film about now.
Well, before we get into the film, I read today that you hadn't even had that much experience bicycle touring before you did this. Is that true?
I, you know, as a kid, I grew up on the North Shore of Chicago in Winnetka, Illinois, where I rode a bike every day to school and to play and whatnot. And that was pretty much, I was a suburban bicycle kid. And that ended in 1977. So I haven't really ridden a bike since then. But this trail, I can't tell you enough good things about what the state of New York has to offer through the Empire State Trail system. It is brand new. The majority of it, at least three quarters of the trail, is specific to bikes and walking only. So you're not competing with traffic. And it's beautifully laid out. It starts along the Hudson River in Manhattan. It moves through the Bronx on the streets, which was a little of a challenge for me, but I learned very quickly that I was capable of doing that. And then it moves up through Westchester County on the Sawmill River Parkway, but dedicated bike trail. There's the safety factor is off the hook. You cross the Hudson River on a walkway that's, again, no cars, to go from Poughkeepsie to New Paltz. Once you get to Kingston, you're on the Rip Van Winkle Bridge. There are cars, but it's very well divided between where the walkers and the bikers can go and the cars can go. And then you move up through territory that I've never seen before. I'm so glad. I know New York now. I knew Long Island. I always thought Long Island was New York. Well, there's a lot of New York out there. See it at 9 miles an hour on a bicycle is really, the town of Tivoli, for instance. If anybody has a reason to go to Tivoli, I encourage them to do so and take some time, because it's a really unique little town. Schuylerville, Essex, New York, phenomenal town on Lake Champlain. All of those towns I have a reference for today.
Yeah. Well, we have a couple things that cross over in this story. One of my best friends and I, she had a lot of bicycle experience. I was like you. I was like a kid on a bicycle. And then as an adult, we went on a 1,215-mile bicycle ride from Canada to San Francisco. And we had done trips without gear. We actually carried gear and camped. So my first ride with gear was driving around Seattle, bicycling around Seattle, completely wobbly, not knowing what I was doing. But, you know, you stay on your bicycle and you keep going 9 miles an hour for 5 weeks and you get good by the end. So I appreciate that. I also appreciate the Hudson River. I was born in Kingston. I spent my summers on the Hudson River, and I'm in New York State, grew up in New York State. So I appreciate that. I had relatives in Long Island who just really thought Long Island and New York was New York, and everything else was cows.
Yeah, there's a lot out there. And one of the things that I intended to do was to maybe uncover some of the hidden gems on the cuisine side. I wanted to find restaurants that were worth mentioning in the film. I wanted to find coffee shops, which I did until I got north of Hudson. Then it became pretty much all about scrambled eggs and slices of pizza and hot dogs. But I imagine in the summertime up there, there's a lot of great cuisine. But I had to do this in March and April, and I'm so glad I did, because today we're very, very busy at the restaurant, and I don't have the opportunity to leave here on a Monday afternoon in order to ride all day on Tuesdays. And that's essentially what I was doing. I Tuesdays are my day off, and so I decided I would ride each section of the trail on Tuesdays until I got north of Albany. And at that point, I made the trips a little longer, and I had some friends join me. And it was wonderful to spend time with men that have been in my life since I was in my 20s and 30s. And Charlie Whittingham, my old boss from Sports Illustrated, which I worked at the Olympics with him back in 1980, Michael Sincue, who was my next door neighbor at my restaurant Estia in Amagansett for 20 years. He owns a wine and spirit shop in Amagansett. And then Jim Levison, who is the fishing guide that I fish with off of Montauk. He really wanted to see the Adirondacks, and he drove shuttle for me. I'd ride from 6 a.m. until noon and then fish into dark with Jimmy. And each of those men played a critical role in the success of my ride, as did Bill Moulton, who was the filmmaker that I've been working with. He also ran shuttle for me on occasion, and he brought the camera out whenever we crossed the river. And he also was with us at the end when it rained and when I caught the northern.
Well, I think your energy and this project and the idea of being close to people that are important to you was just, again, a great model for how to spend this crazy year. It's really admirable. And I'm excited that my listeners can see the documentary. So tell us where the documentary is and how we can find it.
We're in final edit right now. It was exciting to have some local musicians join in, and we just cut the music bed the other day at WLNG, a local radio station. Bill is doing the final edit work now. We intend to enter it into the film festival circuit. The most prevalent one, I think, is the Hamptons Documentary Film Festival, and their deadline is July 15th. So we're pretty focused at that time, and it will then be put on our website, AmericanRiversTour.com, and it'll be a YouTube film, and hopefully it will find entry into that film festival and show at the Sag Harbor Cinema in the fall.
I'm going to be there with bells on. That sounds so much fun. So how do we find out about your restaurant and come see you?
If anyone was interested in seeing our cuisine and how we entertain here, we have a website, estias.com, E-S-T-I-A-S.com. And we've been building on that site for 20 years. So there's a lot of information, not only about the history of the restaurant and the food that we do today, but the recipes. There's a recipe file there that's 10 years old that has everything from our hot sauce to huevos rancheros and our Mexican sweet corn soup. I just am in the process of posting a vegan aguachile recipe right now. So we keep that updated all the time. The menus are on that site. My videos are accessible on that site and on the American Rivers Tour. We've done a lot of videos we call the Seed to Plate series. So there are videos specific to the food that we grow for the restaurant. And the website is it's a chronicle of sorts, and I'm very proud of it. I'm also really proud of our staff, and I appreciate you mentioning that, because without them, I wouldn't be able to leave here and go ride my bike or go fishing or do any of the things that contribute to my life. And when I go out adventuring, I'm always bringing back ideas that end up, you know, enhancing the programming here at our little kitchen in Sag Harbor.
Well, I was in the hospitality field in restaurants for a long time myself, and I'm glad I'm not anymore. I'm glad I can have weekends off. But I so appreciate when I walk into a restaurant and I know just from the energy that the staff is taken care of and respected and they enjoy being there. And that's a tribute to you and the atmosphere you've created. So thank you for that. And everyone, please look for Tuesdays on the Trail. That's the name of the documentary. You can say you heard about it here first. thank you so much for your time. It was an honor to be with you today.
Thanks, Laurel.
Thanks for listening to the Compassionate Leaders podcast. You can learn more about us at CompassionateLeadersCircle.com. Please join us each week as we shine a light on compassionate leaders making a positive impact on their communities and the world.